This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Barbarians at the Gate, written and read by Brian Burrow and John Hellyer. Copyright 1990 and 2003 by Brian Burrow and John Hellyer. Production copyright 1990 and 2007, HarperCollins Publishers.
Barbarians at the Gate, The Fall of R.J.R. Nabisco, by Brian Burrow
and John Hellyer.
Until the fall of 1988, Ross Johnson's life was a series of corporate adventures in which he would not only gain power for himself, but wage war on an old business order. Under that order, big business was a slow and steady entity. The Fortune 500 was managed by company men, junior executives who worked their way up the ladder and gave one company their all, and senior executives who were corporate stewards, preserving and cautiously enhancing the company. Johnson, though, was to become the consummate non-company man. He shredded traditions, jettisoned divisions, roiled management. He was one of a whole breed of non-company men who came to maturity in the 1970s and 80s, a deal-driven nomadic lot. They said their mission was to serve company investors, not company tradition. They also tended to handsomely serve themselves. But of all the non-company men, Ross Johnson cut the biggest profile. He would come, in fact, to be the very symbol of the business world's roaring 80s, and he would climax the decade by launching the deal of the century, scattering one of America's largest, most venerable companies to the winds. The man who would come to represent the new age of business was born in 1930 at the depth of an old one. Frederick Ross Johnson was raised in Depression-era Winnipeg, the only child of a lower-middle-class home. Unlike his father, who hadn't completed high school, Ross Johnson wanted to be a college man, and he took the crosstown bus each day to Winnipeg's University of Manitoba. He was average inside the classroom, but excellent out of it. President of his fraternity, varsity basketball, and honors as outstanding cadet in the Canadian version of ROTC. Upon graduation, Johnson plunged into the middle levels of a string of Canadian companies, where he would muddle along for nearly 20 years with little distinction. It was in his expense accounts, though, that Johnson's real creativity shone. By combining his flair for spending with his gift for flattering older men, Johnson moved steadily up the corporate ladder. Yet at age 32, Ross Johnson was still a nobody. He was making just $14,000 a year. Landing as a middle-level bureaucrat at T. Eaton, the big Canadian department store chain, Johnson found a mentor, a man named Tony Peskett. Peskett encouraged him to indulge his natural proclivity for thumbing his nose at authority. When Peskett fell out of favor, Johnson once more jumped ship, this time landing at a Toronto company named General Steel Works. But by the early 1970s, Ross Johnson was 40 years old and still hadn't run his own show. When a headhunter offered him that chance, he leapt at it, jumping this time to become president of the Canadian arm of an American food company, Standard Brands. Johnson found Standard Brands hopelessly outdated, and he hit it like a hurricane. In his first year, he bounced 21 of the top 23 executives. And to replace them, he looked for the kind of free-spirited young men he'd attracted throughout his career, a growing band of merry men. His confidence building, Johnson settled into a routine that would endure for 15 years, staying up until all hours with his pals, talking business, sipping scotch, smoking cigars. Unorthodox, yes, but his guerrilla band produced results, and it got Johnson noticed. In 1973, he was promoted to head Standard Brands International Division. He moved to New York. Cocksure, buoyant, bubbly, Johnson was utterly unintimidated by the city. At age 42, he was only now starting to find his stride in life. Johnson's new boss, Henry Weigel, was a tyrant who ran a tight, Spartan company. Weigel would pinch a penny until it screamed. At first, Johnson managed to avoid Weigel's wrath. He delivered results and was out of the country half the time, visiting the company's far-flung international operations. But Johnson's flamboyant style guaranteed an eventual collision with his indomitable boss. Always drawn to celebrities, Johnson soon befriended the former football star Frank Gifford, then announcing Monday Night Football and pitching ads for Standard Brand's Dry Sack Sherry. Through Gifford, he met an array of big names, football commissioner Pete Rozelle, race car mogul Roger Penske, broadcast buddy Don Meredith, Rune Arledge, who headed ABC Sports. The giffer, the glitz, the contacts, Johnson thrived. Beaten down Standard Brands executives rallied around this buoyant newcomer. So, too, did he become a favorite of the Standard Brands board.
They rewarded him by naming him a director in 1974 and promoting him to president a year later. In 1976, the board named Johnson chief operating officer, making him Weigel's clear heir apparent. Weigel, who had torpedoed successors before, dispatched a team of auditors to Canada. Eventually, Weigel learned of Johnson's huge New York limo tab, which the company was picking up. He began gathering information on Johnson's extramarital affairs. Johnson, meanwhile, prepared for war. A headhunter who gathered employee intelligence for Weigel became a double agent, also reporting to Johnson. It all came to a head on a Friday morning in mid-May, when the directors convened. Both men addressed the board, and then Johnson left the room while the board caucused. When he returned, Weigel was no longer in the chairman's spot at the head of the table. Ross Johnson had command of a New York Stock Exchange company. Afterward, he and the merry men toasted their victory with martinis late into the night. It had, they agreed, been a splendid coup. It wouldn't be their last. After Weigel's ouster, staid-old Standard Brands became Phi Delta Johnson. Gone was the prohibition on first-class travel. In no time, Johnson leased a corporate jet and acquired a company-owned Jaguar. Overnight, the corporate culture was transformed into a facsimile of Johnson's flip, breezy manner. Johnson had no use for long meetings when short ones would do, or when he was doing a golf course. For that matter, he had no use for traditional business hours. Johnson firmly believed that true inspiration and insight happen only after hours. Babies, he liked to say, are only born at night. On a typical evening, Johnson and his merry men would knock off around 7:30 and head out en masse for the night shift. They'd stake out a table at Minucci's and drink until it closed, convening afterwards at Johnson's new company-owned apartment, where they'd order out for pizza or Chinese. It was, Johnson recalled, like Boys Town. Many executives saw their salaries doubled. Pay at Standard Brands went from the bottom of the industry barrel to the top of the heap. Johnson didn't stop there. In the months following Weigel's departure, he had the company pay for his membership in 18 different country clubs. Standard Brands, which had no corporate apartments under Weigel, had 18 by the time Johnson was through. Always a big tipper, Johnson took to keeping a bulging wad of what he called whip money, large bills that could be readily whipped out of his suit pocket. Johnson's immediate business challenge at Standard Brands was to keep it from collapsing. He tried to compensate for the company's poor showing by devising jazzy new products, an effort that led to what one analyst called some of the most celebrated failures in the food industry, like the ill-fated Reggie candy bar, named for one of Johnson's newest friends, baseball star Reggie Jackson. Through the rough times, the Standard Brands board never rapped its young chief's knuckles. Johnson, mindful of Weigel's fate, treated the directors like kings. Only occasionally would his loud wardrobe or blue language push the board's limits. The party at Standard Brands went on like that for 4 years. Constant upheaval, a string of marketing disasters, ho-hum profits, but lots of fun, money, and perks for Johnson and his friends. But then Johnson became restless. It was as if Standard Brands was a toy he'd gotten for Christmas, and having played with it for a while, he was getting bored. Part of his disaffection was due to the fact that Johnson, now moving into his late 40s, was no longer the boy wonder of the mid-70s. The idea of becoming a sedate corporate elder made him shiver. What was needed, it was clear, was a new adventure. The opportunity came in a curious phone call from a fellow chief executive in March 1981, Bob Shaverly, chairman of the food giant Nabisco. In a matter of weeks, the two executives agreed to merge their companies. Nabisco Brands, as the new company would be called, was formed in a $1.9 billion stock swap, at the time one of the larger mergers of consumer product companies. Technically, it was a marriage of equals, but that was considered so much chin music. Everyone knew Nabisco, with dominant brands such as Ritz and Oreo, was the more powerful company. Everyone knew who would be in charge. At Nabisco, no one was fired. No one worked past five. No one raised a voice. No one, not even the new chief executive, Bob Shaverly, had a company car or a corporate country club membership. Then along came Ross Johnson. It was as if the Hells Angels had merged with the Rotary Club. On paper, Shaverly remained the top executive of Nabisco Brands, but Johnson found it easy to get his way. Their offices were adjacent, and Johnson wasted no time ingratiating himself with the boss. He deferred to Shaverly in every regard, obsequiously addressing him in meetings as Mr. Chairman. Johnson's many country club memberships were paid for by the company. He insisted that Shaverly's dues be picked up, too. Johnson and his executives drove flashy company cars. He insisted Shaverly and his aides do so, too. Johnson's base pay was more than double Shaverly's, requiring a vast raise for the chairman. Slowly but surely, Johnson closed his grip around Shaberly's company. One by one, veteran Nabisco executives began to vanish. Johnson immediately installed Standard Brands people beneath him and replaced Nabisco's financial controls with a system devised at Standard Brands. To some who caught Johnson's act during this period, he was less a business dynamo than a corporate Eddie Haskell, sucking up to Shaberly while kicking the beaver in the teeth. Whatever the case, it worked. Within 3 years, 21 of the company's top 24 officers were Standard Brands men. Even as he reshaped its executive suite, Johnson moved to mold Nabisco's business mix to his own taste. But as successful as his manipulations were, Johnson could see it would take something like wartime conditions to attain a complete overhaul of Nabisco Brands. To his surprise, he soon reached that juncture in a period that came to be known as the Cookie Wars, with Frito-Lay and Procter & Gamble. It gave Johnson reason to wipe out still more of the Nabisco old guard, and it worked. As the smoke cleared, Johnson emerged triumphant, both inside and outside Nabisco. As far as Shaberly and the board were concerned, he could do no wrong. That year, 1984, Shaberly rewarded Johnson by ceding him the title of chief executive. After only a decade in New York, Johnson had achieved the pinnacle of success, CEO of one of America's great food companies. He was a new breed of chief executive for a new age of American business. He was no old-style team player, but a Broadway Joe or Reggie Jacks, an iconoclastic superstar, a cool television age man, loyal to little but his own whims. But even as he assumed Nabisco's throne, Johnson seemed to lose interest in running it. He could no longer see much of a future in it. No amount of work was going to revitalize Nabisco's aging bakeries anytime soon. Johnson, in fact, never bothered to formulate any kind of master plan for reshaping Nabisco. Instead, he spent his time enjoying the high life, putting out corporate fires as they flared, and waiting. Then, on a spring day in 1985, less than a year after being tapped Nabisco's chief, Johnson took a call from J. Tyler Wilson, chairman and chief executive officer of R.J. Reynolds Industries, the North Carolina-based tobacco giant. Would Johnson be interested in getting together for lunch? Maybe, Wilson said, they could do some business.
If not for the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company, the modest skyline of downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina, would not exist at all. On a humid summer morning when there's no breeze to carry it away, the pungent smell of tobacco still hangs over downtown Winston-Salem, wafting from the company's oldest tobacco factory. It serves as one constant reminder why there is a Winston-Salem. The little burg was always enormously proud of its big company, calling itself Camel City. Factory workers in overalls walked into stockbrokers' offices with paper bags full of cash and buy orders for Reynolds Tobacco. Shares were handed from one generation to the next with an admonition, "Don't you ever sell that Reynolds stock." The community's Moravian values became, if anything, even more imbued in the company. Work. Competitors' tobacco buyers returned home and goofed off after the 8-month tobacco auction season. Reynolds were assigned to cull the tobacco leaves they had bought. Thrift. Reynolds workers were expected to turn in the stub of a pencil to get a new one. Ingenuity. The company developed a way to recycle scraps and stems of tobacco to greatly increase the usable amount of each leaf and greatly increase profits. Life was good. In 1960, Reynolds Winston, Salem, and Camel were three of the top four best-selling cigarette brands. It was often said that Reynolds' only problem was how to turn out cigarettes fast enough and how to ship all that money back. America's love affair with tobacco went largely unopposed until 1964, when Surgeon General Luther Terry issued his landmark report linking cigarette smoke with cancer. Cigarette sales, which had risen an average of 5% a year, fell sharply. Growth eventually resumed, but Reynolds saw and heeded the warning and began buying businesses outside the tobacco industry, mostly in the food business. But in the 1970s, senior executives led Reynolds on a disastrous diversification campaign that, in a deterioration similar to Nabisco's, would have far-reaching effects on the company's core tobacco business. In 1983, Tyler Wilson was elevated to chief executive, and he set to work reshaping Reynolds. Wilson's background had been in consumer products, and it was there he believed the company's future lay. Tobacco remained a fabulously profitable business, but even die-hard industry partisans saw the twilight ahead. So in 1985, Wilson began preparations for his biggest move yet, an acquisition that would fulfill his grand vision to mold Reynolds into a consumer goods superpower to rival Procter & Gamble. Wilson set up a task force to sift through and rank the candidates. After many months and countless computer studies, according to his task force, Reynolds' ideal marriage partner was Nabisco Brands. headed by a breezy, likable Canadian named Ross Johnson. Wilson and Johnson met over sandwiches at Johnson's Midtown Manhattan office, and Wilson laid out his plan. Reynolds, he explained, needed a major acquisition to ease its reliance on tobacco, and he thought Nabisco fit the bill perfectly. Wilson told Johnson he planned to retire in 2 or 3 years and hinted strongly that Johnson would get first crack at replacing him as head of their combined companies. Within weeks, a small army of Wall Street lawyers and investment bankers were brought in, and Reynolds agreed to acquire Nabisco for $4.9 billion, at the time the largest merger ever to take place outside the oil industry. For the most part, the first weeks following the merger went smoothly, though there were undercurrents of uneasiness that would resurface. Because Reynolds had acquired Nabisco, news of the merger was greeted favorably in Winston-Salem, where the locals took pride in gaining control of a great northern company. The lone dissenting voice was Ed Horrigan, president of Reynolds' main tobacco business. Horrigan groused constantly to Wilson about the Nabisco executive's perks. "Ross Johnson is a snake, a low-life slime," he declared to anyone who would listen. "We'll rue the day we hooked up with that character." Apart from Horrigan, Johnson was initially well-received at Reynolds. Alone among senior Nabisco executives, Johnson moved to Winston-Salem. In his first weeks there, he made an all-out effort to fit in, driving around in a Jeep Wagoneer, inviting people over to dinner, and joining the board of the North Carolina Zoological Society. Most in Winston-Salem were impressed, but not all. Ginny Dowdle, the wife of Reynolds' treasurer, John Dowdle, sized up Johnson with a single phrase: a used car salesman. Below the top ranks, deep differences in the two organizations were soon apparent. When Reginald Starr, head of the Reynolds Shareholder Services Department, flew to New Jersey for a first meeting with his Nabisco counterparts, he was met by a pair of white limousines with smoked windows. "I don't know. It looked like mafia to me," Starr, a 30-year Reynolds veteran, said. "It was so ostentatious. I was ashamed to be seen in one of those things." As far as the actual business was concerned, under Wilson, any strategic move, from advertising to changing a cookie box, required multiple sign-offs and weeks of waiting. Johnson's merry men, of course, thought Wilson was nuts. To a man, they remained at Nabisco in New York, where, isolated from Johnson, many grew restless. After just 6 months under Wilson's regime, several were poised to leave. Johnson traveled to New York and urged his friends to be patient. Things would change, he assured them. Johnson, meanwhile, was doing his best to ingratiate himself with Tylee Wilson. It wasn't easy. The two men were complete opposites. Wilson cringed at Johnson's expense account. When he got a tab for a $13,000 weekend at a Colorado country club, he asked Johnson whether all that hoopla was really necessary. Johnson could always spin a superb rationale about how piddling the cost was compared to the goodwill his party had engendered with grocery executives. "A few million dollars," he quipped, "are lost in the sands of time." For all their differences in style, Wilson and Johnson rarely disagreed on business matters, and Wilson came to appreciate Johnson's quick mind. Wilson was in fact so pleased with Johnson that he encouraged him to get to know the board members. Much as it had with Henry Weigel a decade before, Johnson's easy charm contrasted sharply with the prickliness of his boss. The beginning of the end for Tylee Wilson came in mid-1986. On a morning drive into his downtown Winston-Salem office, Paul Sticht, chairman of the board's executive committee, noticed a new building going up near the Whitaker Park cigarette plant. "What's that?" he asked his driver, Eddie. "That's where they're going to work on that smokeless cigarette," Eddie said. "What?" Stick asked in amazement. Stick immediately confronted Wilson, who admitted the company had been secretly trying to develop a breakthrough product, a new high-tech smokeless cigarette. Stick was aghast. That such a product could be developed without consulting the board was unthinkable. "How long have you been doing this?" he asked. "Since 1981, said Wilson. 5 years. Project SPA, as it was codenamed, was indeed a revolutionary product. Later named Premier, the smokeless cigarette was Wilson's secret weapon to turn the tide on the anti-smoking movement, smite Marlboro, and reverse the tobacco industry's decline. Whatever its chances of success, the board was incensed that Wilson would attempt such a mammoth undertaking without its approval. He was summoned to explain himself at a July 1986 board meeting in New York. One by one, many of the directors laced into him. When the session finally ended, Project SPA had tentative approval to proceed. It had gone so far it hardly seemed worth canceling. And Tylee Wilson had used up what little political capital he retained with his board of directors. After a year of working elbow to elbow with Wilson, Johnson now struck like lightning. Out of the blue, he telephoned several directors and told them he planned to leave RJR Nabisco. It was time to move on, he said. Having planted the seed, Johnson laid back to watch. Eventually, Wilson saw the writing on the wall. At the following month's meeting, he resigned. To go quietly, Wilson received a princely pact, a lump sum payment of $3.25 million, continuation of his annual salary and bonus of $1.3 million until his retirement at the end of 1987, and annual retirement pay totaling about $600,000 a year thereafter. After the slightest of efforts, Ross Johnson was named chief executive of RJR Nabisco, America's 19th largest industrial company. Well, Tylee Wilson muttered afterward, they got me.
Ross Johnson's rise to the helm of RJR Nabisco, it proceeded with blinding speed. CEO of Nabisco in 1984, the Reynolds-Nabisco merger in 1985, CEO of RJR Nabisco in 1986. If he'd stopped there, history might have looked very differently on Ross Johnson's career. But Johnson, a man who devoted his life to shaking things up, had no intention of changing his ways. Reynolds Tobacco churned out $1 billion a year in cash, enough to fund the wildest schemes and cover the worst mistakes. $1 billion, Johnson said reverentially. You can't spend that much money in a year. Because Johnson still knew next to nothing about tobacco, he had to have a man who did. And whatever their past disagreements, he was determined it would be Ed Horrigan. Horrigan had raged about the luxurious New York apartments Johnson's Nabisco chums had. Johnson now made sure Horrigan got the most luxurious of them all. In the museum tower above the Museum of Modern Art, Johnson gave Horrigan his own personal Gulfstream G3 jet, the top-of-the-line in corporate aircraft, to use as he wished. Next, Johnson began to purge the ranks of the Reynolds old guard. All down the line, Reynolds people were thrown into the streets to make room for Johnson's Nabisco cronies. As Johnson consolidated his control, he shed his small-town poses and reverted to the Johnson of old. Most every weekend he jetted off to some far-flung golf club, tended to his tan in Florida, or hit Manhattan with Frank Gifford and other friends. Under Johnson, RJR Nabisco was finally torn loose from the old-fashioned Reynolds value system. Over the years, the unassuming largesse of Reynolds senior executives had created institutions such as the Bowman Gray School of Medicine. Johnson's idea of good works was the Pro-Am golf tournament he organized to benefit the Wake Forest golf team. The capper was his wife. The town matrons would draw close at the luncheon table. Have you heard the latest? They called her Cupcake. Lori Johnson was a gorgeous blonde in her early 30s. The proper Reynolds wife wore conservative clothes and lots of makeup. Lori bounced around in jogging suits, looking like the California girl she was. The proper Reynolds wife played bridge. Lori was an ace golfer who could drive a ball as far as a man. It was hopeless. The gossips had a field day after Johnson took a top Wake Forest golfer under his wing and into his home. When the young golfer moved into the Johnson's basement, rumors spread that he and Cupcake had been caught in a jacuzzi in flagrante. Tensions flared into the open that November when Reynolds Tobacco announced layoffs. The Winston-Salem Journal expressed its editorial disapproval, saying it hoped the layoffs weren't a sign of things to come under the management of Johnson and the Nabisco Cookie Monsters. For Johnson, it was one of the last straws. I don't have to take this shit, he said. Although he had done his best to disguise the fact, he hated small-town life. To Johnson, there seemed only one conclusion. Move. Relocating RJR Nabisco's headquarters would kill Winston-Salem, drive a dagger right through its proud provincial heart. Johnson knew it, and began laying the groundwork carefully. Atlanta intrigued Johnson. It was nouveau riche and rootless, and deliciously overbuilt. Top-of-the-line office space was going begging. It was near enough to Winston-Salem to be politically plausible. So Atlanta it was. Overnight, Johnson became a local pariah. A country music station had a local hit with a ballad excoriating him. When Johnson described Winston-Salem as bucolic in an interview with the Atlanta Constitution, bumper stickers began appearing all over town. Honk if you're bucolic. Hundreds of workers who wouldn't make the move to Atlanta would be fired. Reynolds veterans who never before worried about losing the shelter of their fatherly employer now lived in daily fear of finding pink slips on their desks. Photocopying machines worked overtime producing underground cartoons. In one, Johnson was depicted as a missing child. The caption, "Happiness is when you wake up and see Ross's picture on the milk carton." Johnson, a man with almost no roots, couldn't fathom the emotions he had unleashed. "Jesus Christ," he said. "Exxon takes 7,000 jobs out of New York. Nobody bats an eyelash. I move a few hundred jobs out of here, and I'm Attila the Hun." The backlash, though, made no difference. Atlanta awaited, its throngs of boosterish businessmen thrilled to welcome a major Fortune 500 company to their ranks. But if the city thought it was getting a warm corporate benefactor eager to put down roots, it soon discovered the truth about restless Ross Johnson. Johnson took over 11 floors in an unremarkable glass tower at a suburban shopping center named the Galleria. In his maiden speech, he suggested that his skeletal headquarters staff should not be reckoned as a dispenser of corporate largesse. It was hardly the attitude city fathers had hoped for. "Don't worry, Winston-Salem," said the Atlanta Constitution headline the following day. RJR move here was no great loss. Just weeks after moving to Atlanta, Johnson again shocked RJR Nabisco partisans when he mentioned almost in passing that he was thinking of transforming Reynolds Tobacco from a corporation into a limited partnership. No one could tell whether it was a certainty or just another half-baked idea sprung from Johnson's unpredictable mind. The announcement, in fact, signaled a change in Johnson's corporate focus. As takeover swept corporate America during the 1980s, Wall Street investment bankers had long salivated at Reynolds' massive cash flow. It begged to be put to use in acquisitions, but they'd never gotten to first base with Tiny Wilson. Johnson, though, was another matter. Here was a man the Wall Streeters could talk deals with. Big deals. Exotic deals. The move to Atlanta, in fact, brought investment bankers streaming south like June bugs to a light on a hot Georgia night. The limited partnership idea had come from one of Johnson's most determined pursuers, a wild-eyed Wall Street dealmaker named Jeffrey Beck. Beck worked for Drexel Burnham Lambert, the sharp-elbowed investment house whose Beverly Hills-based junk bond chief Michael Milken almost single-handedly transformed the takeover business in the mid-1980s. On Wall Street, they called Beck the Mad Dog. A true character, Beck styled himself the ultimate wheeler dealer. While other bankers specialized in analysis or combat tactics, Beck seemed to make a career out of fast-talking and histrionics. Johnson had long been worried that RJR Nabisco's stock price was unfairly penalized because investors never factored in Nabisco, choosing only to focus on tobacco's bleak future. Beck's partnership idea was intended to combat that perception. As ideas like Beck's began to pile up, Johnson handed them off to an informal group of advisors he took to calling his financial R&D department, headed by his old friend Andy Sage and a Washington-based consultant named Frank Benevento. Johnson thought the pair was top-notch. When their work service months later, though, his Wall Street friends would wonder why. 2 months after riling Winston-Salem and Wall Street by mentioning the limited partnership idea, Johnson announced he was no longer considering it. Beck was undaunted. He promptly came back to Johnson with another idea to split up the company, spinning off Reynolds to shareholders and allowing management to acquire Nabisco in a conventional leveraged buyout. For all his free-spending ways, the fact was Johnson remained a prude about corporate debt, the core of any leveraged buyout, also known as an LBO. Banks didn't understand the need for golf tournaments and corporate jets. They cramped his style. No, he'd take a pass on an LBO. His power consolidated at RJR Nabisco. Johnson relaxed and began to enjoy himself. The order of the day was having fun. He stayed clear of Winston-Salem as much as possible. He remained a marked man in North Carolina. One evening, the Horrigans had the Johnsons over for dinner. Talk turned to the burgeoning LBO phenomenon. "Oh, hell, we'll never do a buyout," Johnson said. "We have the best jobs in America." It was no lie. RJR executives live like kings. The top 31 executives were paid a total of $14.2 million, or an average of $458,000 apiece. It was literally the sweet life. A candy cart came around twice a day, dropping off bowls of bonbons at each floor's reception areas. Not Baby Ruth's, mind you, but fine French confections. The minimum perks for even lowly middle managers was one club membership and one company car worth up to $28,000. But it was at nearby Charlie Brown Airport, where corporate Atlanta housed its jets, that the air of new money and restlessness found its ultimate expression. There, Johnson ordered a new hangar built to house RJR Nabisco's growing fleet of corporate aircraft. When it was finished, RJR Nabisco had the Taj Mahal of corporate hangars, dwarfing that of Coca-Cola's next door. The flight planning room was packed with state-of-the-art computers, all necessary to keep track of RJR Nabisco's 36 corporate pilots and 10 planes, widely known as the RJR Air Force. As RJR Nabisco's titular chairman, Paul Stick was appalled by Johnson's free-spinning ways. A lover of the fine things himself, even Stick now thought things had gone too far. Always alert to shifting political winds, Johnson sensed that Stick's power was finally waning. Just as he had earlier wooed him, Johnson now cut Stick off at the knees. After he was removed as chairman, the aviation department was told that if Stick asked for a jet, it would have to be personally authorized by Johnson. When Stick found out, he stopped asking. In contrast to their treatment under Wilson, the directors found that all their needs were attended to in detail under Johnson. Johnson encouraged them to use the RJR Air Force anytime, anywhere, at no charge. "I sometimes feel like the director of transportation," he once sighed after arranging yet another director's flight. "But I know if I'm there for them, they'll be there for me." Johnson thought he had the board in the palm of his hand, but Horrigan wasn't so sure. "This isn't your board, Ross," he told him. "They're just waiting for you to make a mistake." Most people were waiting for Johnson to make his next move. For a year after moving to Atlanta, Johnson made do trimming RJR Nabisco, selling Hoobline and a host of small companies. As money from these divestitures poured into RJR Nabisco's coffers, Johnson used it mainly to pay down bank debt. Investment bankers pestered him constantly to put the funds to better use. "Buy something," they urged. "Put your imprint on the company." But Johnson wasn't interested in building anything. One recurrent rumor had him buying part of Beatrice, the Chicago food giant taken private in 1986 by the leading leverage buyout boutique, Kohlberg Kravis Robertson Company. Johnson knew the chief of Beatrice, Don Kelly. "You should meet Henry Kravis," Kelly told Johnson. "He's curious to meet you. I could set up a dinner with him." Johnson was intrigued. Kravis, whose firm was practically synonymous with LBO's, was a legend on Wall Street. Kohlberg Kravis controlled more than 24 companies it had acquired, using borrowed money, since its founding in 1976. So, 10 days later, Johnson arrived at Kravis's Park Avenue apartment, where he found Don Kelly waiting. Johnson stared goggle-eyed at Kravis's sumptuous quarters. He thought he spied a Renoir or a Monet on the wall. Hell, Johnson told himself, the guy could live well off the liquidation value of his living room. Kravis was a small, intense man with silvery hair, just 43. He spent much of the dinner extolling LBOs, how pouring on debt made a company tighten its operations, how executives could reap millions from little extra effort. "If you're interested, maybe we could get together," Kravis said. "If you'd like, we could send out people to look at your numbers." Johnson was skeptical, although he kept his tongue. He wasn't interested in working for anyone other than himself. Dinner soon ran its course, and Johnson rose to leave after scarcely 90 minutes. He left feeling Kravis was a bright, steady young man. He also felt sure they could never do business together. The following Monday morning, Johnson sat down with Benevento and Sage and took another look at the possibility of an LBO. The basics of an LBO were relatively simple and familiar to all three men. A firm such as Kohlberg Kravis, working with a company's management, buys the company using money raised from banks in the public sale of securities. The debt is paid down with cash from the company's operations and often by selling pieces of the business. Johnson scanned Benevento's work, paying particular attention to the coverage ratios, the cushion between cash flow and debt payments. They were simply too thin. "Who needs the aggravation?" Johnson said. "Forget the goddamn LBOs."
On October 19, 1987, the stock market crashed. RJR Nabisco, which had been trading in the mid-60s the week before, plunged into the low 40s by midday. In the crash's wake, the stock languished there for weeks. It was the beginning of Johnson's road to ruin, for the low stock price would haunt him for months to come. No matter what he did, buyers treated his stock like a tobacco stock, even though 60% of its sales came from Nabisco and Del Monte. Johnson wasn't the only one who noticed RJR Nabisco's low stock price. In January, the syndicated columnist Dan Dorfman mentioned the company as a takeover candidate. Johnson poo-pooed the notion, although some aides grew worried. In the spring, Johnson redoubled his efforts to boost his sagging stock price. At the March board meeting, he gave directors two options. Buy Hunt Wesson, which would further emphasize the company's tilt toward food, or buy back more stock. Having fewer shares outstanding should buoy the price of the stock. The directors, none of whom shared Johnson's growing concern about the stock price, chose the latter. In March and April, RJR Nabisco purchased 41 million shares. The company had traded around $52 a share in anticipation of the buyback, but immediately fell back into the mid-40s. Its price was lower than ever. By the spring of 1988, Wall Street still hadn't recovered from October's crash. With all its other businesses wallowing, Wall Street turned to its one guaranteed source of income. Takeovers. Mergers and acquisitions, M&A, were the ultimate creature of Wall Street because, win, lose, or draw, they produced fees. Just as they had fueled the street's mushrooming growth throughout the 1980s, takeover fees would again prop up the securities industry's profits that spring. Wall Street, in short, became addicted to deals. And the offices of RJR soon became the deal junkies' newest shooting gallery. At the crest of the takeover wave that spring was the merger department at Shearson Lehman Hutton, the fast-growing brokerage unit of financial giant American Express. Shearson was poised to challenge Merrill Lynch as the preeminent Wall Street brokerage. Its merger department was headed by a pair of veteran dealmakers, Steve Waters and Tom Hill, who were eager to make names for themselves. Steve Waters' easygoing manner, forthright attitude, and sincerity, a rarity among his ilk, made him a favorite of Johnson, whom he had known since Standard Brands. J. Tomlinson Hill III was the warrior of the pair, a zealot for the Wall Street trenches. To enemies, and he had a few, Tom Hill came across as an oiled-back Gordon Gekko haircut atop 5 feet 10 inches of icy Protestant reserve. To colleagues, Waters and Hill made an unlikely pair. That spring, as Hill's prestige rose, Waters found himself embroiled in a nasty internal battle to gain better bonuses for his troops. When Waters offered his resignation, it was accepted. Waters wasn't surprised to learn that Hill had been quietly assuring senior Shearson executives he could handle the department on his own. When Waters left Shearson, many on Wall Street suspected Tom Hill's fingerprints were on the dagger protruding from Waters' back. At the top of Hill's damage control list was RJR Nabisco. Ross Johnson was one of the department's 5 most lucrative relationships, and Hill had a hunch he was ripe to do a deal. After leaving Shearson, meanwhile, Waters ultimately accepted an offer from his old friend Eric Gleacher at Morgan Stanley. On his second day on the job, Waters sat down in Gleacher's corner office to discuss what clients they could hope to snatch from Shearson. Johnson topped the list. By late spring, the word was all over Wall Street that Ross Johnson was ripe to do a deal. Jeff Beck knew it. He continued to push Johnson to do an LBO. Ira Harris of Lazard Frere knew it. So did Hill and Walters. Each had his own ideas on how best to twist Johnson's arm. As the bankers circled, Johnson remained transfixed by his stock price. It was like a scab at which he constantly picked. Johnson couldn't leave well enough alone. The old urges to action were returning, and the stock price was simply their latest manifestation. In the name of boosting his stock, Johnson had sorted through dozens of schemes. Plus, he had high hopes for the smokeless cigarette, Premier, which was due in test markets by fall. Rumors swept the stock market the week before that the company was developing a revolutionary new cigarette, and the stock had shot up 3 points. However, Premier was flunking its taste tests. In its U.S. research laboratories, Reynolds scientists found that fewer than 5% of smokers liked its taste. In Japan, another team of researchers quickly learned to translate at least one sentence of Japanese. "This tastes like shit." If that weren't bad enough, the cigarette was hard to draw on. Privately, line executives knew they needed years to iron out the glitches. Yet Horrigan had promised the world it would be out in 1988. As Premier moved toward its fall introduction, further new hopes for boosting the stock arose in June. In a New Jersey federal court, the widower of a lifelong smoker named Rose Cipollone was suing a number of tobacco companies for contributing to his wife's death. Reynolds wasn't a defendant, but Johnson reasoned that a tobacco victory would give his stock a real pop. The jury cleared the industry of conspiracy, but awarded only $400,000 in damages. Johnson waited for RJR Nabisco's stock to spike up. It didn't. Johnson's office became a wailing wall, where everybody came to cry about the injustice of it all. Investment bankers weren't the only new faces in RJR Nabisco's executive suite that summer. Johnson's closest friend became an executive vice president named John Martin. At 46, Martin was part of the Frank Gifford connection. During the 70s, he had been one of the bright young men at ABC Sports. He joined RJR in January 1988 from Oldmeyer Communications, and he and Johnson became inseparable. On organizational charts, Martin didn't appear to wield much power, but he had Johnson's ear, and he began acting as his gatekeeper. Meanwhile, the dismissal of some of Johnson's trusted advisors underscored some unsettling changes. For the first time, he was attracting media attention. Fortune profiled him in a puffy cover story that summer as America's toughest marketing man. Johnson's friends thought he was beginning to believe his own reviews. America's toughest marketing man, they feared, was really becoming America's most out-of-touch marketing man. At the same time, the man who had made a science of stroking directors was growing cavalier about his board meetings. They were fewer and farther between, and were increasingly sloppy affairs. As he had at Standard Brands in Nabisco, Johnson seemed to be losing interest in operating the company. More and more, he concentrated on only two things: having fun and goosing the stock. In July, Ed Robinson and Harold Henderson, worried that the company's continuing low stock price made it vulnerable to a takeover, got permission from Johnson to approach Shearson Lehman about shoring up its takeover defenses. They wanted an array of plans that could be erected at the first sign of a hostile raider. Johnson considered a takeover unlikely, but Henderson insisted they be prepared for the worst. Word that a company was worried about a takeover invited speculation, which inevitably drew speculators. Only five Shearson executives, including Cohen and Tom Hill, were cleared to work on the plan. Hill came up with a code name whose irony wouldn't be clear until months later: Project Stretch. As they searched for solutions for Johnson's concerns about the stock, everyone who analyzed the problem mentioned the possibility of a leveraged buyout. It was a standard solution to any company whose stock drooped. Every investment banker urged Johnson to consider it. Soon, LBO ideas were arriving, uninvited, over the transom. To each, Johnson replied he wasn't interested. For the time being, Johnson seemed curious about every possible scheme but an LBO. His grandest occurred to him in July. For months, he had been trying to interest Philip Morris in combining the two companies' international tobacco businesses into a joint venture. Philip Morris had expressed interest in acquiring RJR's international tobacco business, but Johnson suggested a joint venture of their food companies instead. Philip Morris wasn't interested. Johnson tried to shrug it off. It wasn't as if he had nothing else up his sleeve to boost the stock. Johnson remained ambivalent about an LBO, but a few days later he called Andy Sage and told him to call Shearson and light a fire under Project Stretch. Johnson wanted the homework done by mid-September so they could quickly begin looking at the possibility of an LBO. Later that week, Johnson called Charlie Hugel, mentioning the Shearson study almost offhandedly. "Incidentally, we're having them take a look at whether there's any merit in an LBO. What do you think?" "Frankly," Hugel said, "not much." Hugel himself had confronted far tougher problems than a low stock price, and to him, proposing an LBO was like shooting someone to rid them of a hangnail. "Ross," he said, deciding to hit Johnson where he lived, "you might have to cut back on the jets, the headquarters, the whole way you live. Do you really want to do that?" By the time he hung up, Hugel thought he had talked Johnson out of pursuing an LBO. When Johnson returned to Atlanta after Labor Day, it was only for a day. The next morning he headed to London, where he and John Martin had a whirlwind schedule set up. As Johnson dozed over the North Atlantic a few minutes before 2 o'clock Wednesday morning, September 7th, a policeman in suburban Westchester County, New York, spotted a 1987 Nissan, crushed and overturned, about 300 feet from the road. Nearby, authorities found the bleeding body of Johnson's 26-year-old son, Bruce. Unconscious, he was rushed to a nearby hospital. It wasn't clear whether Bruce was dead or alive. Johnson and Martin hopped on the first Concorde back. On the flight, Johnson lit up a Premier in the no-smoking section. "It'll be interesting to see if anyone notices," he told Martin. By the time Johnson arrived at the hospital, his son was in a coma. Doctors weren't sure when, if ever, he would regain consciousness. On Thursday, Jim Robinson visited. "Ross, all you can do is make sure you're getting the best medical attention you can get. You just have to keep your focus and perspective and go on about your life." On Friday, Johnson stared at his open briefcase. He knew he had to get himself together, get back on track. He decided to take Robinson's advice and plunge back into work. Walking into his office, Johnson brought out a sharp pencil, a calculator, and an accounting spreadsheet. All around him, on the floor and the furniture, he piled reports from his planning department, blue book statements, studies from investment bankers, and computer printouts. He wanted to see for himself if an LBO made sense, for he no longer trusted investment bankers or computers to give him the answer. By Monday evening, he had a feeling. Not only could he raise enough to try a buyout, but he was ready to give it a serious look. Walking to his apartment that evening, Johnson thanked God for giving him something to take his mind off his son. The next morning, he met a Shearson contingent led by Peter Cohn and Tom Hill. Johnson was well aware the project they were contemplating could lead to an LBO 3 times larger than any seen before. Meanwhile, Jeff Beck was perplexed. He couldn't reach Johnson. Something was going on. Beck could feel it. On September 12th, he took his suspicions to a man he had courted just as fervently as Johnson, Henry Kravis. Beck had helped Kravis with a number of deals, including his largest, Beatrice. "I think it's time to do something about RJR," Beck said. "We ought to just arrange a meeting and make an offer." "You're probably right," Kravis said. "Get me the numbers and set something up." Beck agreed. "There's a problem, though. You won't give Ross what he wants." "What's that?" Beck knew that Johnson simply wasn't interested in working for someone else. "For one thing," he told Kravis, "they'll want control of the board." "That's true. We won't give him that," Kravis said. "That's a problem." Later, Beck got back to one of RJR's top executives, Jim Welch, about setting up a conference between Johnson and Kravis. Welch was noncommittal, but suggested they might get together in the last week of October or the first week of November. The Mad Dog didn't know it, but by then his request would long be moot.
Outside the Metropolitan Museum that blustery September evening, there was all the anticipation of a Hollywood opening. Through a phalanx of photographers and reporters, the cream of New York society hustled inside, the ladies clutching their hair against the wind, the men dapper in tuxedos. Few, even in this social stratum, had the connections to throw a private party at the museum, but greeting their guests inside the wrought iron gates of the medieval court that evening was a couple who'd muscled their way in with a $10 million donation. Henry Kravis and his stunning fashion designer wife, Carolyn Rome. The affair was, in fact, an unofficial coronation of sorts for its host, Kravis and Rome, the prince and princess of the newly moneyed set, dubbed Nouvelle Society. Married just 3 years, they had rocketed to the fore of Manhattan society, capturing the imagination of social climbers everywhere. Yet for all the attention, Kravis himself remained something of an enigma. Friends inevitably described him as kind, gentle, and upbeat. Qualities, of course, that never quite came across in his business dealings. There was a steely glint in his eyes that made one want to believe the stories of unbridled greed and ambition, and there was an air that hinted at something tightly coiled beneath, a sense, however slight, of menace. Practically unknown just 5 years before, Kravis and his secretive firm, Kohlberg Kravis Roberts & Company, had ridden Wall Street's leveraged buyout boom to prominence in the mid-'80s. If it were ranked as an industrial company, the businesses Kohlberg Kravis controlled, from Duracell batteries to Safeway supermarkets, would place it among the top 10 U.S. corporations. Now, with $45 billion in buying power, Kravis was the unquestioned king of Wall Street acquisitors, his war chest greater than the gross national products of Pakistan or Greece, his clout rivaling that of any in financial history. For 6 years, from 1976 to 1982, Kravis and his partners Jerry Kohlberg and George Roberts had fine-tuned the craft of the LBO. They plugged along, quietly dominating their obscure little niche of finance. Then, as so often happens on Wall Street, someone noticed. Suddenly, everyone wanted to try this LBO thing, even though few knew how it worked. And try it they did. In the 5 years before Ross Johnson decided to pursue his buyout, LBO activity totaled $181.9 billion, compared to just $11 billion in the 6 years before that. A number of factors combined to fan the frenzy. The Internal Revenue Code, by making interest but not dividends deductible from taxable income, in effect subsidized the trend. That got LBOs off the ground. What made them soar was junk bonds. Of the money raised for any LBO, about 60%, the secured debt, comes in the form of loans from commercial banks. Only about 10% actually comes from the buyer itself. For years, the remaining 30% came from a handful of major insurance companies whose commitments sometimes took months to obtain. Then, in the early 80s, Drexel Burnham began using high-risk junk bonds to replace the insurance company funds. The firm's junk bond czar, Michael Milken, had proven his ability to raise enormous amounts of these securities on a moment's notice for hostile takeovers. Thanks to junk bonds, the LBO buyers, once thought too slow to compete in a takeover battle, were able to mount split-second tender offers of their own for the first time. Suddenly, LBOs became a viable alternative in every takeover situation. Because they held out the promise of operating autonomy and vast riches, Kohlberg, Kravis, and other firms were swamped with requests from chief executives to become white knight rescuers of their raider-besieged companies. It was a symbiotic relationship repeated in deal after deal. Raider seeks target. Target seeks LBO. And raider, target, and LBO firm all profit from the outcome. The only ones hurt were the company's bondholders, whose holdings were devalued in the face of the new debt, and, of course, employees who often lost their jobs. But in the sheer joy of making money, Wall Street didn't pay too much attention to either group. No sooner did LBOs blossom than critics took aim. The vast debt assumed by post-LBO companies worried many, including many in government. In mid-1984, the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission predicted that the more leveraged takeovers and buyouts now, the more bankruptcies tomorrow. A top executive of Goodyear Tire and Rubber went a step further, labeling the LBO an idea that was created in hell by the devil himself. By late 1987, of the $20 billion in equity poised for LBO investments worldwide, Kohlberg Kravis controlled $1 of every four. Fully leveraged, it gave them enough buying power, enough money, Fortune magazine pointed out, to buy all 10 Fortune 500 companies headquartered in Minneapolis, including Honeywell, General Mills, and Pillsbury. Wall Street had never seen anything like it before. Wall Street, in fact, didn't know the half of it. For the first time, Kravis and Roberts had sought and received permission from their pension fund investors to secretly accumulate stock in their targets. These so-called toehold investments, a mainstay of corporate raiders like Boone Pickens, would give Kravis and Roberts negotiating advantage with chief executives and allow the firm to profit from the inevitable run-up in a target company's stock. A reaction to its new competitive environment, this tactic, more than any other, institutionalized Kravis's new, more aggressive bent. But this approach required Kravis to walk a fine line. Most pension funds, the major source of his money, were either barred from or leery of hostile takeovers. Just a whiff of hostile action could scare off investors and irreparably damage his franchise in strictly friendly leverage buyouts. If Kohlberg Kravis were branded a raider, what chief executive in his right mind would want to work with it? As stock prices plummeted in the crash of October 1987, Kravis and Roberts made their move, swooping in and secretly buying vast chunks of several major U.S. corporations. In 1988, they brought the LBO idea to one of these companies, its identity still secret, and were rejected. Then, at the end of March 1988, Kravis unveiled a 4.9% stake in Texaco. For 2 months, Kravis and Roberts attempted to talk the oil company's officials into a buyout or some type of major restructuring. They couldn't. The problem, it soon became clear, was that Kohlberg Kravis was all bite and no bark. With one eye trained on their pension fund investors, Kravis and Roberts couldn't bring themselves to make an outright hostile bid, and everyone knew it. It wasn't just new deals that were turning sour, either. After shedding many of its businesses, Kravis was finding it impossible to sell the remainder of Beatrice. The problem was a nasty knot of liabilities that no buyer wanted to take on. All in all, it had been a rotten year. Rejected by his targets, competitors nipping at his heels, Kravis couldn't be blamed for falling into a foul mood. When Jeff Beck mentioned approaching RJR Nabisco, Kravis hadn't thought much of it. Kravis sent out dozens of similar feelers every month. On October 5th, Kravis breakfasted with one of his favorite investment bankers, Steve Waters of Morgan Stanley. "What's going on with RJR?" Kravis asked. He hadn't talked with Johnson since their meeting a year before. "I've rethought some of my objections about tobacco liability," he told Waters. "Maybe we should see if Ross might want to talk." Waters telephoned Johnson later that day. Jim Welch returned his call. "Henry would really like to sit down with you guys," Waters said. "Well, that's interesting," Welch replied. "But Ross is busy right now. Let us think about it. We'll crank through the numbers and get back to you." Waters' call should have been a warning, but Ross Johnson ignored it.
As his sleek Gulfstream jet descended through the clouds over Atlanta that Friday evening, Peter Cohen, CEO of Shearson, pondered the long weekend ahead. The following morning, October 8th, Cohen was to meet with Ross Johnson for the first time in nearly a month. Tom Hill's team had been assembling data for weeks, although Johnson still hadn't signaled whether he would go through with an LBO. Cohen hoped they would find out in the morning. Cohen looked like a tough guy, and for years that's pretty much what he was. As a longtime aide to one of Shearson's founders, Sandy Weill, he had earned a reputation as a hatchet man. Turning 40 and taking the reins of Shearson had mellowed him, or so it seemed. Friends talked of how Cohen had grown in recent years, meaning he no longer publicly labeled critics assholes. After the 1987 stock market crash, Shearson's earnings had begun to sag. Cohen badly needed a fresh stream of profits. When Ross Johnson switched course and began contemplating LBO scenarios, it looked like the answer to Cohen's prayers. An $18 billion buyout could wash away a lot of problems. The mere fact that they had carried it off, the largest LBO in history, would instantly catapult Shearson into the top ranks of merchant banking firms. The upfront fees alone, maybe $200 million in all, would be a gigantic boost to Shearson's flagging earnings, and it wouldn't stop there. For years afterward, the money would continue to stream in. It was enough to make Cohen's head swim. Cohen had worked on only one LBO in his entire career, but Johnson's friendship with Jim Robinson, combined with the deal's potential impact on Shearson, compelled him to take an active interest in current negotiations. Saturday morning, the Shearson team of Peter Cohen, Tom Hill, and others settled into Johnson's office, overlooking a sea of Georgia pines. Johnson, accompanied by Horrigan, Sage, and Henderson, had brought along the newest member of the team, Stephen Goldstone of the Wall Street firm of Davis, Polk, and Wardell. At 42, Goldstone was a curious choice to advise the RJR Nabisco executives. As a tactician, he was virtually unknown. For a decade, he had worked on the bread-and-butter underwriting and mid-sized acquisitions on which the securities industry was built. The talk in Johnson's office that day was cordial and covered a variety of issues. Tom Hill was surprised to find out how thoroughly Johnson's people understood LBOs. The pupil, in fact, was about to tell the teacher how class would be run. Central to the success of most LBOs is a ruse known as the gun-to-the-head strategy. In it, a group of senior corporate executives secretly works with a Wall Street firm such as Shearson to assemble financing. Once the financing is lined up and an offering price agreed on, the chief executive presents the bid as a take-it-or-leave-it proposition to the board. The idea is to keep the entire process secret until a deal has been cut, ending the bidding before it can begin. Johnson wouldn't hear of it. He had seen this board exact its wrath on Tylee Wilson for lesser transgressions. Nor was he willing to let Shearson arrange financing or do anything else that, if leaked, would anger directors. Diverting from accepted LBO strategy made Cohen and Hill uneasy, but they had no choice. Without Johnson, they had no deal. If the board chose to publicly announce their overture, it would blow their tactical advantage. Everyone in the room knew the only one strong enough to put up real competition was Henry Kravis. But Shearson and Johnson were lulled by the same fundamental fallacy. They felt certain that no one, not even Kravis, would attempt a buyout this size without the help of a management team to identify the best ways to cut costs. Just as Shearson took it on faith that Johnson could handle his board, Johnson took it on faith that Shearson could raise enough money to buy the company. In fact, the firm had never attempted anything like it. Price was never a matter of serious debate. Both Hill and Johnson thought a bid around $75 a share made sense. It was higher than the stock had ever traded, around $71, although not by much. It could go higher, Hill warned. The board would try and negotiate a better price, perhaps as high as the low $80 range. Johnson got visibly queasy when talk turned to paying more than $75. The higher the price, the more debt had to be piled on. The more debt,